Penguin Random House Audio presents The Sweet Taste of Muscadines by Pamela Terry. Read for you by Exy Sands. For Andrew, Jim, and Steve, and for Pat, always. After dark vapors have oppressed our plains for a long, dreary season, comes a day born of the gentle south, and clears away from the sick heavens all unseemly stains. John Keats. Life is a mystery. Everyone must stand alone. I hear you call my name, and it feels like home. Madonna. Prologue. The first time Mama died, I ran off to hide in the Muscadine Arbor. She'd been coming around the corner of the swimming pool with a tray of iced tea in her hands when Abigail stuck her leg out and tripped her. I don't think Abby really gave it much thought before she did it. It was just an impulse, like a sneeze, over before she even knew what happened. Mama should have just fallen into the pool. She would have been mad, and Abby would have been in for it, but that's about all. Might even have turned out to be a funny story to tell company. But no, Mama split her head open on the concrete before she fell into the water, sinking like a stone to the bottom while we all just sat there staring. Red blood floated up like Easter egg dye. The world counted to three, and then everybody started screaming. I think it was Uncle Audie who fished her out, but I was running flat out by then. They told me later she died just like I thought. She wasn't breathing at all for a minute or more, until Aunt Jo pushed everybody out of the way and started pounding on her chest like you do on a round steak, and Mama woke up spitting out mouthfuls of chlorinated water. But by that time, I was deep in the middle of the Muscadine Arbor, hidden by the vines, getting used to the idea that my mother was dead. When my brother Henry finally found me, the afternoon sun was turning pink behind the pine trees, and I had pretty much written a brand new narrative for my future. I could almost see myself, handling Mama's funeral with a dignity far beyond my years, moving serenely through the crowd of grieving relations in an unwrinkled black dress. Then the letter would arrive. The letter telling us the army was sending Daddy straight home from the war because they'd never allow Henry, Abigail, and me to be left all alone now that Mama was gone. Of course, it didn't work out that way. Mama was only dead for about as long as it takes to fry an egg, but 3 weeks later, when a bullet found Daddy's left temple on that road in the jungle, he was dead for good. The principal came to get me from English class just as Miss Hester was telling us the meaning of the adjective capricious. It became a word I would forever associate with God. I dreamed about the Muscadine Arbor last night. It must have been August, because the lime green leaves were so thick the summer sun couldn't find a way in. I sat in the middle of the arbor, cross-legged in the shade, like I used to when I was little, with my bare toes dug down deep in the brown velvet dirt. What I didn't see was Mama lying there beside me, face down with her legs stuck out the end of the arbor, her fuzzy blue slippers all gummy with pollen and dew. Dead for the second and very last time. But that's exactly where Abigail said she was when Abby found her this morning at dawn. Part 1. Chapter 1. As a child, I was afraid of tornadoes. Actually, afraid is a puny word to describe how I felt when an unusual stillness would thread the air of a late spring afternoon, weaving a blanket of quiet that silenced birdsong and suspended the breeze. The skies over Wesleyan would darken to horror green, and the wind would awaken with the soul of a dervish, causing the pines and poplars to wring themselves into fraying, flailing knots. Though meant for good, the sound of the tornado siren was as welcome as a scream. As the witchy webs of lace curtains reached out for me in the wind, I would run through the house in blind panic, grabbing up my diaries and favorite photos, all the books I could carry, all the while herding a grumbling Henry before me like a wayward sheep. Into our dark rabbit hole of a cellar, I would vanish like Alice to wait it out, nervous and shaking, while in my mind's eye, I could clearly see the swirling evil coming right down my street like the dark finger of God, casually tracing a line on the earth. The world was always unchanged when I reemerged, and the next hour or so was spent putting back the treasured items I'd saved from threatened obliteration while enduring the teasing of my family for my oversized, misplaced fear. Then came the afternoon of Lolly Carmichael's 7th birthday party. Any party at the Carmichaels was a dress-up affair, even 7th birthday ones, so I found myself sitting in the back of our family's green Pontiac in a pink, full-skirted dress with my feet trapped in black patent leather shoes, riding to the event in a sulk on a beautiful day in May. As we neared Lolly's house, I felt a bit vindicated when I spied dark clouds rolling in, threatening rain. At least we wouldn't have to endure outside games trussed up in these clothes. But my glee was waning as we pulled up the drive to a giant's footfall of thunder. Egg-sized drops of rain spattered my pink shoulders as I ran up the stairs, my beribboned present tucked underneath my arm. The front door flew open, and Mrs. Carmichael, face white tight, called past me to my mother. "Geneva, get in here! There's a tornado!" My worst fear in the world, and I was away from home in a pink dress. Mama ran inside, and we scrambled to join the rest of the party, all huddled together in the center of the family room, away from the windows. A rainbow of balloons floated near the ceiling, a big number 7 written on each one in gold. A stack of presents teetered on the dining room table, pink punch, waveless, in a cut glass bowl. The tornado siren blared just then, sending shivers up our bare legs and causing Marianne Archer's mother to blurt out, "Oh, Jesus!" in a voice as shrill as the siren itself. "Hush up, Jesse," my mother hissed. Just then, as one, every balloon in the room popped, a sound that shattered our stoicism and uncorked Jesse Archer's full-throated pleas to the heavens. We scattered like frilly buckshot into every nook and cranny of that house. I grabbed Lolly, who'd frozen to the spot, wailing, and made for the basement along with the more sensible members of the crowd, my mother included. We left Mrs. Archer standing right in front of the window, hands raised in either terror or supplication. I never knew which. If you stick a microphone in the face of someone who's been through a tornado, you can bet money they'll say the familiar line, "It sounded like a freight train." It almost seems a scripted description, but I can empirically say there's a reason for that. From my hiding place that afternoon in Lolly Carmichael's basement, that is precisely the sound I heard as I sat with my head down and my hands clasped around my knees as though bound to a railroad track with no hope of escape. I could hear it coming. Hear it hit like a battering ram. Hear it continue on, leaving the Carmichael house totally, eerily silent as we waited to breathe again. Mama was the first one back up the stairs. Throwing open the basement door, she gasped when she saw the trunk of a tree sticking like a tongue depressor through the gaping mouth of the living room wall. The air smelled sickly strong of pine, and looking up, I could see a nonchalant blue sky already pushing the darkness away to the east. We found Mrs. Archer sprawled across the hooked rug of the family room, her right leg twisted behind her like a strand of spaghetti, her hand still raised to the ceiling, loudly praising God for her salvation. To which Mama replied, as she picked up the phone to call for help, "God, nothing, Jesse. If you'd been listening to God, you'd have been downstairs with the rest of us with not even a run in your stocking." Mrs. Archer had a slight limp for the rest of her days. Maybe once you face down something so frightening, it loses its power over you. I've never been afraid of tornadoes again. And my reaction to the news of my mother's death this morning was not as dramatic as it probably should have been. After all, at 8 years old, I'd spent an endless afternoon believing her dead. I'd already experienced the shock, the hideous fascination of her passing. The fact that her death had ended up false didn't lessen all I'd felt that day. Those same feelings now returned to meet Abigail's news, squeezing themselves through the telephone wires to grab me around the throat, but being somewhat familiar, their power was lessened. So I didn't sway, I didn't gasp. Instead, I asked Abby for the answer to what was, for me at least, the strangest part of the story. What on earth was my mother doing out in the Muscadine Arbor? In rapid-fire fashion, Abby told me that's exactly what she wanted to know. She delivered her account with an urgency undiluted by the drawl of her words, which shot through the phone like honey-coated bullets. "I don't have a
Sample complete. Ready to continue?